There's a place where dreams are born. It's across the sea and through the storm. Now listen, come with me to this magic hour in ecstasy.
Thursday of every month at 8 p.m. This is a radio show of unapologetic romanticism and utopian yearning for people with unlimited vision. You can expect deep dives into counterculture, counterhistory, altered states, ethnobotany, radical anthropology, esoteric explorations, and other worlds on Earth. What worlds? Other ones. Other than what? Other than the ones you're familiar with. Where? On Earth, where we live. I aim for this program to be a small contribution to countering the cynicism of our times, a lighthouse in the distance, keeping the light on all night, just for you. I also have the humble goal of creating a temporary new world for you to inhabit in the space of an hour, and for you, the listener, to feel truly transported there. Leave your worries and doubts behind, just for this hour. Expand your mind and your vision, and see what you leave with. I've become pretty interested in the placebo effect. Like most people, I heard of placebos in the context of placebo-controlled clinical trials. These are trials of new drug treatments where some of the people being treated receive the drug being tested and the others get a placebo. The simplest example is with drug capsules taken orally where you can't really tell what's inside. Some get capsules with the new drug and some get capsules with something like sugar, which is just meant to give some weight to the capsule and make it similar to the others so people don't know what they're getting. A placebo is any kind of treatment, sometimes also called a sham treatment, which, in isolation at least, is not expected to do anything. Those conducting the study want to see if the new drug outperforms the placebo, and the group treated with the drug under investigation has better outcomes than the group that was just given the sugar pills. For a long time, I vaguely understood this as some sort of convention, where you're supposed to have something to compare an effect against, and so the placebo is just a simple control so that you're able to say, we did nothing to this one group, then we did something to this other group, and ideally you want the group that got the drug being tested to do better than if you did nothing. But this understanding is not entirely accurate. The popular notion that placebo treatments are the same as doing nothing is wrong. Placebo treatments very often do something. If you give someone a sugar pill and tell them it's medicine to treat their illness, a lot of people end up getting better, sometimes way better. Consistently, on average, people do significantly better than if you did literally nothing. The design of placebo-controlled studies is not based on comparing new drugs with doing nothing. They're based on outperforming the positive effect of placebo treatment, which is known as the placebo effect. It doesn't happen with everyone in every situation, but if you take a group of people and give them a placebo treatment, you can expect pretty reliably that more than half of them will see some improvement. Placebo-controlled clinical trials were not the gold standard for new drug investigation until around the mid-20th century. Before then, many trials just involved one group testing the drug in question, and they observed the effects. So when you do this, you still end up having positive effects just from the act of giving someone medicine, no matter what it is. And then you may have a stronger effect or additional side effects, which you'd assume to be from the drug under investigation. But when a study is designed like this, it can be hard to parse out the cause of various effects. The placebo effect becomes baked into the results, and with no control group, it may appear that a new treatment is the cause of improvements. But you may also just be witnessing positive placebo effects, and the drug being investigated isn't doing much on its own. Once the placebo effect became well known and firmly established as something to expect in these trials, a standard emerged based on the idea that new drugs should perform better than placebo, because if they perform just as well, then what's the point of the drug, which may have other unwanted side effects? You may as well have just given them a placebo treatment. Now, doctors in general are not very keen on prescribing placebo treatments, or in their minds, fooling their patients into believing they're getting a different drug than what they're actually getting. But even if a new drug under investigation isn't actually being compared to a treatment given in the real world, at least on a large scale, there's still the idea that if your new drug isn't better than a placebo, then it's not worth giving to people. This is, in a way, an arbitrary standard. It's based on seemingly two contradictory ideas. On the one hand, the placebo effect is strong enough that if something else is stronger than it, then that's a good indication it might be useful for actual treatments that are being prescribed. The placebo effect is strong enough that it's being used as a comparison with new drugs whose effects are unknown to see which will win in a competition. Yet placebo treatment is also not generally considered a real treatment option because it's considered the same as not doing anything. So it's kind of considered something and nothing at the same time. If our goal was to compare new treatments against a control that was truly being given nothing, then it would be better if literally nothing was done to them at all, as opposed to a ritual around doing something, which is essentially what the placebo treatment is by design. Following a group which has received no treatment at all is also something done sometimes, but particularly in the context of drug investigation. Placebo-controlled trials are the dominant and most common design, despite the imperfect nature of them. To help understand this in a different way, particularly in terms of comparison of strength of effects, let's imagine you had a series of people playing games of pool against a single person who knows the basics of pool but is not that good at it. They know the rules and can get the balls in occasionally, but are not a good or highly trained pool player. But they're better than someone who's never played pool before. They have some hours of practice under their belt. Sometimes they can play really well, but it's a bit unpredictable how well they'll do and how often that will happen. In my example, this person represents the placebo treatment. I feel like all of us can identify with this example, as we all have games we are okay at on a basic level, where we can sometimes perform very well, sometimes very poorly, often just okay, but always better than someone who knows literally nothing about the game. So you have a series of people play one-on-one games with this person. Some of them are at a similar skill level, and some are professional pool players. You could probably imagine what would happen here. Some will perform worse than the placebo player. Some will perform about as well and produce games that are a tie. Some will perform a bit better, and we'd expect the pros will perform way better. But the placebo pool player here isn't the same as no player. It's not like they're putting no effort in or not scoring any points, nor is their performance the result of random chance. If that were the situation, we'd expect all of the competing players to perform better. But they don't, because that's not the situation. Now, I give this example just to illustrate that no one would look at a setup like this and claim the placebo player here is the same as the other players playing against no one, or someone who is completely incapable of getting any balls in, or even moving the cue ball at all. And it's not like they're playing against someone just performing random motions which may or may not move the balls on the table. That would be absurd. Yet that's pretty much how placebo is often thought of in the context of this standard. It is a Janus-faced effect that is both meant to be nothing by design and yet is also something which is being competed against, which is not nothing, and performing better than random chance. The placebo effect, by the way, does not only involve sugar pills. Beyond sugar pills, they've done trials evaluating things like types of surgery to establish how effective they really are against placebo. Knee surgery for osteoarthritis often does not perform better than a sham treatment, despite being costly both physically and economically to people that receive them. In these studies, they made an incision on the knees of both the placebo group and the non-placebo group. One group got the full knee surgery, while the other group just got the incision, and then they sewed them back up. Not only did the real surgery group not outperform the placebo group, but many in the placebo group had positive benefit which lasted several months out at the follow-up appointments. Amazingly, placebo treatments have also been shown to reduce the symptoms of people with Parkinson's disease. These are just a couple examples, but there are many. So what's going on here? It's clear that the placebo effect is not coming from doing nothing. Doing literally nothing would produce no result. And the reason it often does do something is not related to the actual treatment itself in isolation, but has something to do with the context in which it's being given. Why this happens is far from understood. Answering these questions of what's being done, what's causing the change, and why such a phenomenon exists at all is very tricky. In the past few years, there's been a revival of interest in the placebo effect, mostly in the context of how to use it more intentionally for treating or enhancing treatments of various ailments, and how to best implement that. One thing that's been learned is that if you give people a placebo and tell them it's a placebo, you still often get an effect. From the examples I've seen of this, it's not given entirely dismissively, like, take this, but it won't do anything, it's useless. It's given in a positive manner, but without concealing what it is, more along the lines of, at a minimum, this is a placebo, it's just sugar in the capsule, but some people get better when they take it. There is still a positive expectation set, and the context in which you're getting it, or that it's being prescribed in, is still the same. If we're to assume the environment is playing a role, which it likely is, then that environment is the same for placebo and non-placebo treatments. So based on this, in recent years, there have been more of what's called open-label placebo trials, which means they prescribe placebo pills for various ailments without concealing that it's a placebo being given. One amazing example from these trials is a woman who suffered for 15 years with a severe case of irritable bowel syndrome. Among other symptoms, she regularly got cramps, which were, in her words, worse than labor. She tried everything over the counter and everything her doctor recommended, but nothing worked. She joined a study testing an experimental treatment for IBS, which turned out to be an open-label placebo study. When she learned this, she at first was disappointed that a real treatment wasn't being given. Although all the real treatments had so far failed her, so she figured she might as well give it a shot. She was prescribed placebo pills, which she took twice a day. After 4 days, all her symptoms disappeared. 15 years of pain and nothing working for her. Yet with a few sugar pills, she was symptom-free almost overnight. She wasn't quite sure why, but suddenly she had her life back. Then when the trial ended and she stopped getting the placebo pills, all her symptoms immediately returned. This sadly went on for several years, as she wasn't able to participate in any of the other studies going on, disqualified based on having already participated in the past. Eventually, one of the doctors involved in the study she had been part of agreed to see her privately. Now they meet every 6 weeks for an appointment where they discuss her condition and he prescribes her more sugar pills, which continue to be the only thing helping. Placebo treatments are getting a lot more attention, particularly for conditions which don't currently have good options available. There's these open-label placebo trials, departments in hospitals being established to study the placebo effect, and conferences where researchers share what they've learned so far. One thing we've learned as a result of this research is that the placebo effect can be enhanced depending on the design of the medical ritual, and there may be a way to tailor the placebo treatment to particular ailments. For example, the effect appears to be stronger if people are told a medication is hard to get or expensive. And color may also matter, with people responding better to blue pills as sedatives and white pills for pain. Undoubtedly, cultural associations are playing a role here. In a March 2017 study, 164 people participated in an experiment in which a doctor induced a small allergic reaction on their arms through a histamine skin prick test. All the people developed a red swollen mark on the prick, but the size was much smaller among the people who thought their physician was highly competent and warm because of behaviors like making eye contact and calling the patient by name. and who received affirmation from their doctor that a cream for the reaction would lessen the symptoms, even though there was nothing pharmacologically active in it. What the competent doctor said about the cream, either that it would make the rash worse or better, actually affected the physical appearance of the rash too. People in the study had the largest bumps when they received the same treatment, but felt their doctor was cold in personality and didn't offer any assurances that the cream would help their reaction. Not only that, but what the less competent doctor said about how the cream would react with the rash made no difference at all on its appearance. The placebo effect is not challenging to reproduce, and there's a lot of experimentation going on with it to see how it can be enhanced and best utilized. We are quite far from any consensus, though, on how it's actually working. One idea put forth is that the effect is explained by what's called classical conditioning. This is the theory behind Pavlov's experiments with dogs, where a certain response through training is paired with an otherwise neutral stimulus. For example, he would play a given sound before feeding a dog, and over time, this would condition the dog to begin salivating and expecting food when they heard the sound, even with no food visible. It's thought that this kind of training can happen unintentionally based on the experiences of animals as well as people, and may explain phobias and things or situations which trigger panic. You can also undo unwanted conditioning through a process called counterconditioning. So the idea is that people are perhaps already conditioned to associate healing with a setting where there are friendly doctors or the simple act of taking a pill. When you look at a pill bottle, it may tell you it's a pain reliever, so you'll take that pill expecting pain relief. Similarly, if you're taking a placebo pill in the context of attempting to treat pain, then you may also have a latent expectation that your pain will decrease. But there's a black hole of explanation here, which is any explanation of why you appear to have an innate ability to heal, but need a somewhat mysterious external stimulus to induce that healing. This is where another theory comes into play, a theory of resource allocation. The idea here is that if the environment is stressful, the body will not allocate as much resources to healing because there's more pressing concerns. When the environment is less stressful, the body devotes more resources to healing. The immune system can initiate resource-intensive processes in the body. It needs to decide when is the best time to use those resources, and it may not always be advantageous to initiate these processes. If you're in a situation where there is a perceived threat to survival, real or imagined, it would not be an advantageous time to focus on healing an already existing illness or injury in the body. The priority is to survive, to get away from the threat. Later, ideally when the threat is no longer present, the immune system may devote more resources to healing because the environment is safer. But maybe sometimes this resource management system can get stuck in a state where it's not devoting the energy needed to respond to the illness or injury. Perhaps the person is chronically stressed, or perhaps something else entirely is going on that leads to this state. In this resource allocation theory, this is where placebo comes in and is able to provide an external stimulus that somehow is able to signal to the body that it should now initiate processes of healing. Assuming this theory is true for a moment, if we think of societies where there is a shaman or a medicine man or woman, we can imagine that they are playing an important role of doing regular rituals which bring people back to states where the body can heal. This would be a positive adaptation to this natural, culturally independent process in the body. They learn something, which modern science largely rejects, to the detriment of health. We can get a false impression that societies that lack access to vaccines and other modern medicine interventions are entirely lacking in healthcare, but it's a different healthcare, which is not simply lacking these effective modern interventions. They also have things which we're lacking, rituals that initiate the body's own innate abilities to heal and feel better. Even on a basic level, these are rituals which may induce greater states of relaxation or focus, which could be states in which the body needs to heal. In cultures such as ours, we lack these kind of intentional, regular, collective, or even individual healing rituals, which may potentially help to prevent ourselves from getting stuck in a state where our healing abilities aren't functioning. What if by relying largely or only on, for example, pain medication to alleviate pain, we've conditioned ourselves to be dependent on those specific pain medications in order to feel better? I don't mean dependent here in a classic drug dependency sense, where one must adhere to a regular regimen of intake of a particular drug or else they'll go through a withdrawal process. I mean that regardless of an obvious physical dependency that's recognizable, maybe we condition ourselves to never call on our body's innate ability to endure and alleviate pain because we've trained ourselves to need a Tylenol stimulus to experience pain relief. I think this could be applicable to a wide variety of other situations in which the placebo effect has been shown to work. It may be that the placebo effect, in our very modern sense of using the word placebo with doctors in white coats administering sugar capsules, may be a modern holdover from the same kinds of effects gotten from religious or spiritual rituals. The positive effects from these rituals are sometimes observed by those from outside the cultures practicing them and explained by the placebo effect, usually in a way that's dismissive or mocking, like, oh, they think it's their God healing them when they do this ritual. And if there's any resulting benefit, it's merely the placebo effect. But where is this dismissive, casual observer getting their placebo effect? This effect may be more complex than we know, and we may be experiencing it in little or big ways all the time, but only taking notice when it happens in the context of these controlled clinical trials. But when I ask, where's their placebo effect? What I'm really asking is, where's their regular ritualized healing? Where's their practice to return to a healthy baseline after a stressful event? Where's their community, which is reinforcing the expectations from the practices that produce positive benefits in the individual? We're rejecting a category of healing, not because it doesn't do anything, but purely based on ideology. And more importantly, we're not replacing it with anything. Some in our culture have caught on to this and have started to take on some of the spiritual practices that may lead to better health outcomes. I read an article recently about a guy talking about taking up a daily chanting practice, which comes from Kundalini yoga, to ward off dementia. I know that sounds hokey, but there is evidence a practice like this has real positive benefits in the brain in this regard. Remember that thing I mentioned before regarding ways to enhance the placebo effect in the medical context? Like how if medication is presented as rare or expensive, there's a greater effect? Something else we've learned is that there tends to be a greater effect, or at least a greater likelihood of an effect, the more complex the ritual is. We've all heard of complex spiritual rituals involving chanting, holy water, prayer, induction of altered states of consciousness. On this last point, mind-bending psychedelic substances have gotten a lot more attention in the West in the past few years for their mental health benefits when taken with care. But it's worth noting, for the substances which have a root in traditional practice in other cultures, they're very often, if not mostly, used for healing physical illness and injury. They're referred to as plant medicines for a reason. These applications for these substances have gotten far less attention by the world of science. It's very possible some of the compounds in these substances do act directly on certain ailments, but it's also possible there's a very powerful placebo effect happening, which is inducing the body's own innate ability to heal. You'll notice that in all my discussions so far, I'm not making any claim that healing appearing to result from religious or spiritual rituals is caused by supernatural agents, as most of the rituals often do claim. I'm also not discounting that possibility wholesale, or the possibility that there are real unknown forces and energies at work in the universe which have not been adequately described by science or religion. We don't know what we don't know. But while I find exploration of those questions interesting, I'm sticking to phenomena we know is happening and that we don't understand. It's not a question of whether or not placebo treatments or religious rituals have appeared to induce healing processes in the body. We know they have, and this has happened on a spectrum of intensity ranging from minor pain relief to miraculous cures of debilitating diseases. Just because we don't understand exactly what's happening, and just because the exact effect isn't reproducible every time with every person, doesn't mean the phenomena isn't real. It just means we don't fully grasp the mystery. And yes, I am lumping together placebo effects from sugar pills and religious healing rituals. That does not make the sugar pills magic, nor is it meant to explain away or besmirch the healing rituals. What I think is useful is to view them all in a broad common category of effect. Science in 2024 has decided it's comfortable with the existence of the placebo effect, even if it doesn't understand it. And similarly, someone who believes in supernatural agents directing healing can incorporate into that belief that a doctor giving sugar pills is perhaps unintentionally tapping into the ritual magic of a shaman. Every step of the medical process involves countless rituals. You sit in the waiting room silently. You could look at this as akin to a meditation prior to seeing the healer. You're asked to fill out forms detailing your personal history, because illness does not exist in isolation, and the whole picture needs to be taken into account. When the nurses and doctors are at home, they're not dressed how they are here. Here, they're dressed in ritualistic healer attire, Western medicine style, of course, but not unlike the special regalia of a shaman, worn for particular occasions. The office is decorated with instruments and also certificates attesting to the capabilities of the doctors you see. Before you even meet them, you're already in the midst of a process of building trust with them based on faith. Faith in the university they were trained at, faith in their instructors, faith that they've kept up to date with the appropriate rituals for the appropriate illnesses, faith in the medical system as a whole. Many of the things I've mentioned, like the dress, is purely cultural and communicative of concepts of trust and authority. In a strictly utilitarian sense, some of these attributes could be dispensed with, yet you'd also be a bit miffed if you didn't see them, because they're part of the ritual. And yes, many of the things going on have very, very good reasons behind them with lots of explanation. But religious pilgrimage sites, like that in Lourdes, France, also have explanations for why they do rituals in a particular way, and they can show you a catalog of miracles attributed to the way they do things. I'm reminded of something discussed by Hamilton Morris, host of the excellent television series Hamilton's Pharmacopoeia. He's become a big advocate for the Sonoran desert toad, whose dried venom has gained popularity for containing a powerful psychedelic compound. Due to the increased human predation of this toad, it has become quite threatened as a species. So Morris has become an advocate for leaving the toads alone. The drug contained in the venom that collectors want, 5-MeO-DMT, is easily produced in a lab synthetically and is chemically identical to what you'd get from the toad. So Morris argues this is a viable and preferable alternative to bothering these toads, but many people claim the experience of 5-MeO-DMT from the toad and from the lab are not the same, and Morris acknowledges this is true. He does not agree that the experience is different because there's anything chemically different, but says it's different because knowing it came from a toad rather than a lab creates a different mindset going into the experience. It colors your expectations. And this is surely even more true if you caught and milked the toad yourself. As I also discussed briefly in the last episode of this show, the concept of set and setting, which comes from the psychedelic world, can be applied to other substances and activities to explain the effects that are produced, which can't be entirely explained by the substance or activity itself. Set is the mindset of the person, and setting is the environment in which the experience is taking place. When this concept first emerged in the early 60s, it was a novel one because up until that point, the scientific world tended to be dismissive of mental or environmental factors influencing the effect of a medicine. It smelled too much of unscientific thinking and implied a difficulty in perfect reproducibility. This is still a very strong sentiment today. Nevertheless, researchers were forced to acknowledge that these factors strongly influenced the psychedelic experience. There was an interesting study that came out of Johns Hopkins University a few years ago. They wanted to test if seasoned users of psychedelics could tell the difference between different drugs based on the effects. So they brought together a group of people that were very experienced with these substances. The average number of experiences for a person in the group was 50. They gave them either psilocybin, the active compound in magic mushrooms, or DXM, the active compound in some cough syrups, which acts as a hallucinogen at higher doses. While both hallucinogens, these substances are very different chemically and generally thought to produce very different effects. Anyone familiar with these substances would probably think it was a silly study with predictable results. Of course people this experienced could tell the difference, but it turns out that when blinded from what drug they were being given, the people in this group could not meaningfully tell them apart, and gave vivid descriptions of the effects they experienced, which aligned with what they expected they had been given. This reveals just how powerful set and setting can really be. Psychedelics have sometimes been called non-specific amplifiers, in that they tend to amplify already existing mindsets and environmental influence, with of course a decent amount of their innately chaotic chemical personality thrown into the mix. The fact that psychedelics more dramatically demonstrate the influence of set and setting shines a spotlight on the importance of these factors, which may be more difficult to see with other drugs. But we know that even more boring everyday drugs like acetaminophen will be less effective when an individual is overly stressed. It's a mistake to conclude that the effect of one's mindset or the environmental impact of things like ritual practices are only something that's relevant to psychedelics. The study of psychedelics has rather illuminated the influence of these factors on probably many things, which is something we're only beginning to try to understand again. A few years ago, I got a gift of tea whose packaging described it as lucid dreaming tea and claimed it was a long-used Algonquin herb known for its dream-enhancing effects. I immediately looked it up online and could find no evidence of this being the case. I don't mean there were no clinical studies evaluating the dream effects of the herb. I did not expect to find that. I mean that I found no evidence of these effects being associated with this herb by anyone, and found discussion of others who had looked into the claims on the packaging and concluded that there appeared to be nothing to back up these claims of traditional Algonquin use for dream enhancement. And basically, it seemed like a cheap marketing stunt. Nevertheless, I tried it a few times, and nothing happened. But years later, a friend of mine had been talking about how he had this dream tea that had quite powerful effects in his experience. There is a category of plants which are thought to affect dreams and have quite a lot of people's experiences to back them up. I naturally assumed he was talking about one of these other better-known herbs and was curious which one it was. I was astonished when he showed me a picture of the box of tea on his phone, and it was the very same one I had gotten years ago. For him it worked, and for me it didn't. And more critically, I think, he had not researched the tea online and had simply believed the claims on the packaging. So he didn't have the cynicism I had about it. The placebo effect is stronger in children than in adults. Children also have dramatically less cynicism than adults. They usually don't have years of being lied to and run through the ringer of this society like the rest of us. They're willing to simply believe. A cynical adult is constantly battling belief and acting scornfully toward others' beliefs. So I would expect something like the placebo effect to be resisted more effectively by people like this, people like us. That it works at all in our society is testament to how powerful or maybe even how important it must be. Why does it matter what you believe at all? If we're not built in a way where believing in things is significantly important, and especially if there's the degree of mind-body separation that has dominated Western science for so long, then why does what we think matter in a way that affects physical health? Clearly, you can believe in nothing and be completely cynical and pessimistic. You can survive like this, but is it optimal for health? You can also survive purely on candy and can also survive hitting one of your fingers with a hammer every day. But no one would claim these are good ideas. They're not good for you. And things that are not good for you are things we're not built to handle optimally long term. A being with hooves can step on a cactus and crush it with no perception of discomfort. But we have sensitive feet, which cannot be expected to have the same result, even if it usually won't kill us. It's probably worth trying to examine what's good for us and what isn't. The ubiquity of spiritual practices suggests to me there's something we're missing out on if it's completely absent. And the vast diversity of those practices shows that this doesn't have to mean emulating or joining any particular religion. The anthropologist Wade Davis points out that 50% of the world's 7,000 languages are no longer being taught to children. He argues that language is much more than vocabulary and grammatical rules. Every language is an old-growth forest of the mind, a unique answer to the question of what it means to be human. I think we could extend that to religions and spiritual practices also, which in many ways attempt to answer that question more directly, and so are an even more direct reflection of how different cultures conceive of themselves in the universe. Groups and especially societies engaging in spiritual rituals are not constantly running controlled scientific studies that compare the results of people doing the rituals and those not. One might say they randomly fell into these behaviors, and it's all accidental. Without doing a controlled comparison, how would people know if there's any positive benefit? Aren't they just blindly and slavishly following cultural traditions they were born into? But why do so many fall into these behaviors which have supposedly accidental benefits? Why intuitively do they keep doing them and see a connection between the ritual and the benefit? I don't know the exact answers to these questions, but I sense that given how universal spiritual ritual practices are, this likely reflects an adaptation to the needs of the self and the community, or perhaps even an instinct. It's felt by those doing the practices that it's something they need, something that's essential. Again, I'm not advocating for any specific religion or spiritual practice here. I'm merely pointing out that we've largely removed these things from modern life and haven't replaced them with anything. So whatever positive benefits there were, whatever needs they were responding to, are now often going unfulfilled. It doesn't feel natural to not believe strongly in anything. Placebo is a treatment that on its own is not expected to create any change, but the change it can create is based on the set and setting of the person experiencing it in ways that can be unconscious. So this got me thinking about the concept of the collective unconscious. There is a spectrum of understanding about this concept. On the wildest end of the spectrum, we have things like collective dream analysis, which tries to establish if there are psychic links between dream experiences and if people can experience the same dreams together. There's also this idea of a waking collective consciousness as a proposed explanation for why there's evidence that many inventions and similar societal changes happened around the same time in history in different parts of the world without any obvious collaboration. The idea that if knowledge is already known, or a problem has already been solved somewhere, it becomes easier for someone else to do the same thing, because it's almost like they've done it before, and they're able to tap into the psychic record. There's even the idea that the source of consciousness itself is not the individual brain, and is instead a force that permeates the universe, with the brain being a kind of radio that can tune into it. But even on the less wild side of the spectrum, there's an obvious effect certain events can have on the wider collectivity. Simple actions by individuals like breaking windows, or more extreme unplanned events like natural disasters, are things that happen frequently, and on their own in isolation, are not expected to have any effect beyond the most obvious and immediate ones. But sometimes, there is a larger social effect. Politically speaking, these single events can be triggers for riots, rebellions, or even revolutions. These are not examples of events which are innocuous, like a sugar pill, but they are in the same vein in the sense that neither are usually expected to create larger effects. The task of revolutionaries has long been to try to come up with a science of understanding why certain events trigger larger collective responses and why others don't, even when the category of event is the same. If the events can be understood, then one can, in theory, predict the collective response to unplanned events, or even predict the response to planned actions. Many, if not most, actions taken by revolutionaries are often critiqued as merely symbolic. This is the cynical impulse to put all actions into states of isolation where one can easily question what the point of them are and what the connection is between them and changing the world. The defensive response to this critique, which has a lot of truth to it, is that no one single action can ever on its own change the world. It necessarily takes many actions, and it's unfair to look at one in isolation and evaluate whether or not there's a point to it, because its utility may not be understood in the short term. Also, there's an idea of actions having worth on their own for the people doing them, and that they serve as good practice, building experience that will be helpful in future, potentially more impactful actions. But it cannot be denied that sometimes the same actions have very different effects in different contexts, and so another way of thinking about this is that every action taken by revolutionaries are similar to placebo treatments, in that they are experiments with different rituals in an effort to find the right combination of factors, the right magic dust, to start the fall of the dominoes that could lead to a new world. Like the more dramatic unexplained miracle cures attributed to the placebo effect, there is a sense of timing, of built collective consciousness, of planets becoming aligned, and of faith in possibilities that makes the birthing of a new world possible. Rituals which must be performed in such a way to have effects on the larger social body. We must struggle to understand these connections and continue to experiment so that we can believe that one day we can win. the task at hand is nothing less than the manifesting of the kingdom of heaven on earth. The last shall come first, and the first shall come last. And for the first time, life will triumph over death. Now I'm going to bring in a friend who I had some discussions with about the topics I've been talking about, and we thought it might be fruitful to have some of those discussions together on the air.
Well, I really like that your discussion about the placebo effect was so centered on the importance of ritual and belief in our lives. I think when we take so much of it does feel sometimes like so much of our discourse as anarchists is built around this kind of trying to understand like a science of revolution, trying to figure out why revolts happen when they do, trying to figure out why a window breaking at one moment creates a larger impact than at a given other moment. And I think that's often to the detriment of looking at just how important the beliefs that motivate us to not just to keep carrying out political actions, but also to construct the communities that exist, both that give context for us to those actions, how important those beliefs are, as well as how important the rituals that we engage in actually are to our political action itself. There was this great play in this journal, Baden 2, on anarchist ritual. And the editors of the journal kind of gave a little spin to David Graeber's Fragments of an Anarchist Anthropology, which was kind of about how to do like anthropology from an anarchist lens. But in this case, they took a bunch of rituals that, for example, fire starting or the black mask or these other they gave an almost initiatory spin on so many ritualized anarchist practices. And I found when I first read it, I found it really powerful because it valorized and highlighted the rituals and beliefs that are so important to us.
So I think the thing that I've been getting at is like that if we're to, and I feel like this is something that, you know, anarchists talk a lot about, is this concept of total revolution. We're always like, don't want any stone unturned. Like, it's not just about the economics. It's just not just about the political arrangements. It's not just about, you know, different forms of oppression. It's not just about racial oppression, gender oppression, et cetera. It's like we're always kind of want to imagine this total kind of revolution. And I'm not the first person to suggest that there needs to be, you know, an overturning of and reimagining of like spiritual possibilities. But I do think it's legitimate to say that like any total revolution would also be a spiritual revolution. And particularly with kind of what I was trying to say before about there being kind of this inadequacy, this kind of, you know, some of these positive things that we've lost that I think the placebo effect kind of illuminates in like the Western scientific minded, you know, cultures of the world, like the one we live in, like we've dispensed with certain practices and I don't feel like we've adequately replaced them. And so I feel like if we're to imagine like a new world, I'd also feel like it's important to imagine like a new spirituality that, you know, maybe it could borrow some things from existing spiritualities, but it's, I feel like there, a lot of people might be interested in trying to imagine what a new spirituality would be, what like, you know, values it should have.
Yeah, I mean, I think that you're absolutely right that it's an essential component of, and you sort of said a little bit before how, you know, it gets pretty thorny when you make claims about what you know, what is essential to humanity or what humans essentially need. But I think that, I hope that it's becoming less controversial in our circles, because it's certainly less controversial in, I would say, in, you know, the world at large, to think that a spiritual component to a life is absolutely essential, and that any real revolutionary practice is going to require that.
I know that you're involved with a collective here in Montreal that's putting on a interesting event this month. Do you want to talk a bit about that?
Yeah, absolutely. So the last weekend of May has been, for over two decades now, a time when anarchists in the city can come together and share all of the ideas and projects that they've been working on with each other and with people who are just curious about the activities and ideas that we get us so excited. And it's been amazing to come together with a really diverse group of people in order to...
But what is that, the thing that's been going on for so many years? You're talking about the book fair, right?
Yeah, the Anarchist Book Fair, which is, for people who don't know, a lot more than just books. It's an opportunity for people to sell art. It's an opportunity for people to share the zines that they've made. It's an opportunity for people to give workshops and skill shares on the things that are really exciting them in that moment.
You said you've been going to it for about 10 years, but it's been going on for longer than that. Do you know how many years? It's over 20, isn't it?
Yeah, it's been going on for over 20 years. And when you look back at, and you know, in this era of the anarchist movement, when you look back, it's these kinds of gatherings started in the late 80s.
Oh, like book fair gatherings? I didn't know that.
Yeah, there's this one space in Montreal called DIRA, which has an archive of zines and newspapers, and we were able to find one program for a similar book fair type event in Toronto in 87 or 89. For a number of reasons, the Anarchist Book Fair Collective canceled the event this year, and the community really came together to put on an event so that we would still have that place to form connections with each other and share the things that we're most passionate about.
So my understanding is that, yeah, this original collective that had been doing the book fair for a few years is just fatigued, and there's a number of factors that went into them saying that they didn't have it in them to do the book fair this year. And in a really inspiring reaction to that, there was this response from the community where a bunch of new people have gotten involved and really want to make it happen and want to even improve on it and have it not just be limited to a book fair. So it's still going to be a book fair, but there's going to be tables with books, and there's going to be workshops and the usual things, and it's going to be in the same location, the same buildings that that the book fair is usually in. But my understanding is you're really trying to imagine it as a larger thing outside of that original model.
Yeah. Well, I think the way that we see it is that it's more an attempt to carry on and expand the tradition of the book fair itself. When the book fair was canceled, it gave us the room to sort of rethink exactly what we wanted to see from the event and to change the way that the community engaged with it. We named it a festival in order to be able to open it up and try to give people the impression that they could hold events and to give people the context, to say that we're building a context in which people can hold their events without necessarily the festival organizer's input. You know, again, we're just a group of people who are putting this event on. We don't have any more legitimacy over trying to decide what does or doesn't happen than anyone else in the city, you know, who's part of our community. And so creating an open calendar that would allow anyone to post an event.
See, you really want to... this new collective around doing this
really wants to encourage a more autonomous, kind of decentralized approach to how the event is going to happen. It's called Constellation, right? And the title is meant to kind of imply that?
Yeah, exactly. The Constellation metaphor is a way of trying to say that, of trying to link the various anarchist projects that are happening in the city and just sort of demonstrate the ways that we're interlinked. One of the most important parts of that is that we don't all share the same definition of what constitutes anarchism. It's one of the reasons why making sure that the festival is as decentralized as possible was so important to us. We think that that diversity in opinions and beliefs is one of anarchism's greatest strengths. It's one of the things that makes it, as a political movement, as flexible as it is. And creating an open schedule, creating a tabling event where the criteria for having a table wasn't whether or not we agreed with a political line, but asking a tabler to answer the question how they see their project as anarchist or how they see their project as of interest to anarchists would be something that could open up, that could really open up the possibilities of what people could present and share with each other.
I know you still have people writing in and signing up for things, but you know, right now, how many tablers do you have signed up for the event?
Well, we already have 75 tablers. So the book fair itself will be as large as it always is. And then in addition to that, there's an entire other day of events and activities on Sunday, which are planned at some of the locations that mean the most to us in our community that we use, that will allow the groups of people who use those spaces to invite others to come and see what makes them so special.
Are there a good number of people that have, reserved spots to have talks in different rooms?
Yes, but that actually brings up another one of the things that we're most excited to try out this year, which is having, in addition to having rooms set aside for planned events, discussions, skill shares, or film screenings, we're also opening up space for people to give impromptu events of a similar nature. So it's not going to be necessary for people to propose them. There'll be an informal sign-up sheet, and people will be able to make use of the space on their own terms. Again, it's something that we're trying out for the first time, and having this opportunity to see what's really possible is something that feels both really inspiring and also drives us to put in the work to make sure that it can happen in a way that makes sense.
So are there any talks or events as part of Constellation in particular that you're really looking forward to?
I think the events that I'm looking the most forward to are the ones that are going to be, that are going to fall under that spontaneous umbrella. I can't wait to see what people come up with. And in addition to that, I'm really excited to see what the other organizing groups have put especially on the Sunday. Again, they've curated their own events.
Because Saturday is a bit more formalized book fair thing that you guys are more intimately involved with organizing the facilitation of, but then Sunday is more driven by outside input from outside the collective, right?
Yeah, entirely driven by people from outside of the organizing group. Groups like Aura, the groups like L'Insoumise, Dira, Les Révoltes, or Première Ligne, they've all come together and organized their own events. And again, they've organized them autonomously. They organized them without needing the input of any kind of centralized group. And so I'm excited to just see what they're putting on. I think one of the things that I'm most excited for is the party Saturday night. Every year, the party is incredible. There's going to be DJs playing all night. And biking back from the location to my apartment is always with my friends is just one of the best parts of the weekend. Often I've had to go home early because of the tabling happening on the Sunday morning. which I've been involved in and have had to cut the evening short. But because most of the events are starting a little later, around noon on the Sunday, I'm looking forward to finally being able to party all night. So yeah, if people want to know any more details about the event, you can just head to constellation.noblogs.org.
That address again is?
constellation.noblogs.org. For any other information, and hope to see you there.
So on that, we'll conclude this month's episode. If you want to listen to this episode again, or any others that have previously aired, you can go to ckut.ca and search for Other Worlds on Earth. There you can also find my contact information, and you can sign up for a low-volume mailing list if you'd like to be notified when new episodes come out. Other Worlds on Earth airs every first Thursday of the month at 8 p.m. on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal, or streaming online at ckut.ca. I hope this show has helped you expand your mind and vision. I look forward to us meeting again next month and floating on the airwaves together.